bliss was in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. William Wordsworth's famous lines have captured the delight and excitement of youth ever since he first wrote them in the 1790s. Except this decade, very few in Gen Z would claim they're in heaven, worried about debt, the future, and how they get on the housing ladder. All the contestants under 35 in the recent series of Traitors said they would use any prize money they won to get on the housing ladder. All the contestants, they've been robbed of the glorious sense of possibility that youth confers. It was so intoxicating in the 1960s that the Who could sing, "They hope they died before they get old." But now it's the old who are sitting pretty and the young perplexed and out of sorts. What's happened between the generations? What positive news is there for the post-90s generation? To tell us are two esteemed guests. Bobby Duffy is Professor of Public Policy and Director of the Policy Institute at King's College London, and has just stood down as the chair of the Campaign for Social Science, the advocacy arm of the Academy of Social Sciences. His book, Generations, Does When You're Born Shape Who You Are, is one of the most illuminating books I've read on the generational divide. Kerry Oppenheim is a project lead on the Nuffield Foundation's Journeys to Adulthood program. Using young people's voices and robust data, Kerry and her team are exploring the challenges and opportunities young people face as they transition into adulthood. Lots of crossovers between your work. So welcome to the We Society podcast. Lots to discuss. Let's begin. Kerry, what's going right, if anything, in kind of this catalogue of woe in the introduction? Is there any kind of shafts of light for people?
Yes. So I think also if we look back over the last two decades, you can see some important signs of progress. So if we look at educational standards, overall, they've improved and we do well compared to our sort of international peers. We see some decline in what are called social harms. So things like problematic drinking, smoking, although, of course, we have increased this in vaping. Teenage pregnancies, really sharp decline, though again, slight uptick recently. So there are definitely things that have improved that provide a foundation for this generation's lives and futures. But of course, there are major challenges. The major challenges, COVID is still winding its way through this generation. And we've seen that very closely from the work we've been doing with young people themselves. Digital lives, I'm sure we'll talk about, and all the issues around low well-being and mental health and how those combine, as well as economic precarity, the uncertainty with which young people have to navigate, you know, the labour market and job opportunities. And that, of course, is really, really crucial.
And Bobby, I mean, my father came to adulthood in the 1930s and was keenly aware that a world war was about to break over him and his generation. And he would have said, precarity, challenges, the prospect of kind of dying was kind of very real. Mm. I mean, is it really so much worse now than then?
Yeah, there are a lot of structural factors that have moved against young people. So people from that generation have done much better economically in terms of building their wealth and their stability in later life, and then particularly the baby boomers who came directly after have done much better. No, but I think every generation faces its challenges. I think one of the things that makes this one feel quite so pointed is we got really used to generation-on-generation progress post-war. We had this kind of sense that each generation is going to do better than the previous one. That became like a natural order of things. That felt natural, that your kids were going to do better than you. But actually, it was quite unusual. And it's kind of, that was an unusual period of growth and sense of social progress. And now, this kind of stagnation and reversal feels much more pointed to the generations because we've got used to that kind of sense. So it's not saying this generation has had it tougher than that generation directly. It's just the trajectory has changed really sharply. And we see that in our data. So when I ask a survey question back in 2003, do you think today's young people are going to have a better or worse life than their parents? Half of people back then would say, yes, it's going to be better. A quarter would say worse. You take any survey since 2008-09 financial crisis, and those figures are almost exactly reversed. So only a quarter think life is going to be better for young people. Half think it's going to be worse for young people. And it's actually gone down since then. So you get into the teens now. Only 19, 18% of people thinking young people are going to have a better life today than their parents did. So it has changed, but it's that sense of trajectory and that loss of promise of post-war, everything's going to keep getting better.
Now, I'm tempted to dive off into the big international reasons why, you know, the order's changing, but I'm going to stick, contain the conversation, otherwise we're going to go mad. And Kerry, when you hear that, what's your nodding away, or what are you thinking?
That's very much how we see it and what the data and research shows. Yeah, they're a combination of structural changes. So, for instance, take AI. The sort of swiftness with which that's sort of running through some parts of the labour market. And interestingly, there's an early career survey which showed that 10% of respondents, these are young people that respond to this survey, were already changing their career plans in response to AI. Of course, obviously, that's quite possibly a good thing to do because they're taking account of those changes. So I think there's a combination of legacy, as exactly as you said, Bobby, of, you know, actually the financial crisis, 2007-08, sort of still playing through, but then also these new factors that play into how young people sort of perceive their futures and the futures that their current circumstances. I mean, child poverty rose substantially over the last period, and people in our youth insight group that we work with as part of the project that I lead, facing major issues in terms of affordability, you know, not being able to pay for the kind of social connections and activities. And also there's been that impoverishment of youth clubs, youth services, all of the kinds of extra things that society can support young people with have really been decimated over the last 10, 15 years. So I think these are real, real difficulties, you know, alongside other positives.
Which include marrying later and divorcing less often.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the constants in this is that we think what we grew up with was the natural order of things. And that's just human nature. We think we went through that. And I always, when I do presentations on this, I use the example of my mum, myself, and my daughter. So my mum left school at 15, went to work full-time in a factory, and that was basically her life story. That was kind of what she progressed to. By the time I was 17, I'd had like 10 different jobs, and all rubbish jobs that probably, you know, they taught me different things, but it was like, you know, working in the corner shop, working in Sainsbury's, working in Boots. I didn't actually officially resign from my job at Boots. I'm still employed in Boots somewhere. You just walk away from these jobs.
You're probably finding a great pension from Boots.
Yeah, I hope so. I'll look into that. You know, the things we really shouldn't be doing. Overnight office.
They're owned by private equity, so I doubt it.
Overnight office removals for 17-year-olds, completely unsupervised. Things we shouldn't have been doing, really. And then you come to my daughter, 17, the only paid things that she's ever done is selling stuff on Depop and Vinted. And it's stuff that we bought her and it's stuff that we do the admin for. We do all the admin for it. When you say that to people, they kind of laugh at that sort of cosseted type of generation coming through. But then when you look back, you think, so my mum's model is wrong in people's minds. That's too young to be going out and trying to live your life. Our model is right, and my daughter is too cosseted or growing up too slowly. But the purpose of this is to get us to step back a bit and think, actually, look, we only think that's the natural order of things because we grew up with it. The reality is she's got a 50% chance of living to 90 years old. She's likely to be working for 50 years throughout her career, maybe going a little bit slower at the beginning and delaying things like leaving home, getting married, having kids, getting a job, all of those types of things, is maybe not such a stupid thing to do. There's no kind of perfect balance here in this spectrum from kicking everyone out of school at 15 into jobs through to what they're doing. And so I think society adapting to different models of growing up, I think, is really important. And it's really important to question our own biases and presumptions about actually what's right and wrong in this.
So what conclusions do you draw from that? I mean, this is what you're about to kind of explore at Nuffield, isn't it? Right?
Yes, yes. So I think that's really interesting because the work that we've been doing is with it's a project called Grown Up Journeys to Adulthood. The question mark there is not to imply that they're not grown up, this generation. It's to ask the question of what it means to be grown up in the context of the things that you were just describing, Bobby. So these later transitions may be a good thing in some cases. The sort of way in which we support young people, state or local state or other activities, is still fixed with a sort of old model. So a good example of that would be mental health difficulties. So at the moment, we know that they start arriving in young people's lives. The onset of them is in adolescence. The services that we have are under huge pressure, and they separate people out into pre-18 and after 18. And quite a lot of what we heard in this project that we're doing, which contains quite a lot of youth engagement, was the struggles that people had between moving from child and young people services to adult services. They were lucky, you know, if they managed to get some service before they were 18, then, you know, they soon had to move into a completely different service. So, and this is not saying that we want to infantilize this whole generation, but it is about thinking, are the way in which we provide services and offer support is based on an old model of when we think people are kind of embarking on some key sort of stages in, I guess, milestones of adulthood.
Milestones of adulthood. I mean, I just as you've been talking, Kerry, I was thinking to myself, you know, what does it mean to be adult? I mean, I'm kind of, I'm surprised. I mean, I'm seriously older than you two, but I'm amazed at how, you know, I still ask myself the question, what am I going to do when I grow up? You
know? Very healthy.
Well, yeah. I may be saying goodbye very soon, you know. Define adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is a socially determined definition. It's going to mean different things in different eras, and it's a societal construction. That is a good question in the sense that us understanding that those definitions can shift over time and not always in a bad way. I mean, going back to Kerry's point, it was so interesting about the mental health services, because we did some work in Australia where they have re-scoped and reshaped their mental health services just to stop that break point between 18-year-olds. That through flow of need is just absolutely through into the 20s. But it doesn't mean to say that we've got a border, hard border between one day you're a child, one day you're an adult. It is a series of events. And what I try to do in the book is separate myths from realities about generations. And when you boil it down to what are the real realities of difference between these cohorts of young people and previous ones, it's not to do with life cycle effects, which is just young people, and not to do with period effects, which is just what's going on in society at the time. I come up with three. And it is the economic realities, which we've talked about. It is the mental health realities. And the third is this delayed adulthood. And I call it delayed adulthood. Mm. Others in psychology do talk more about emerging adulthood, that there is an element of this which is self-exploration, where you're having more time to find yourself as an adult. I think that's a bit wrong in the sense that some of that is emerging and some of that is self-exploration. Other elements of that is constraint on people, that this is not something they're choosing to do. It's something that
the
economic circumstances are making them do. So those enormous increases in young people living for longer with their parents is not a choice. It is for some, but it's not a choice for lots of people. And that does have implications for how you live your life and your levels of freedom, etc. So it's a delayed adulthood. Some of it chosen, a lot of it imposed because of those other factors, and particularly the economic factors. And so we have retooled and reshaped society through these bigger forces, structural changes that has having a direct impact on people's lives. I mean, just trying to keep the optimistic element of it, and there's lots of reasons, lots of problems with it. I do come back to, we did not happen upon the ideal way to run a society and transition into adulthood just at the time that we happen to grow up. Mm. That is, you've got to fight against that bias, that anything different from that is unnatural. And I do think we've got a chance now to think about how do we retool these societal and structural supports and barriers to support this longer transition into adulthood exactly in the way, but it does take action in the way Kerry is suggesting, it's not just going to happen organically. We do need to think about how do services knit together, how does support, how does education, and do we genuinely have a policy for lifelong learning at the minute? Not really.
I'm not at all. Let's be honest about it. I mean, lifelong learning, what's that?
Yeah.
Kerry, you've been nodding away.
Yes.
Run with the ball. What do you think?
So I think it's really interesting to think about what we mean by adulthood. So when we talk to the young people about what they saw as key markers for themselves, I mean, they weren't all the sorts of things you'd expect, but they were about things like having financial security. They were also about things like their sort of emotional development, the ability to make decisions themselves, and obviously being able to make decisions yourself is also dependent on things like your economic circumstances, but not all. They also talked, interestingly, rather than talking about we're in old money, but rather than talking about milestones, they talked about inch stones. Educational categories really dominate, I think, the way in which we think about these phases of life. And actually, what we see is people go, make progress and then may go backwards. And also, it's an accumulation of changes. So
inch stones.
Yes.
Very nice.
That's a nice line.
Yes.
Nice sentence. Nice noun, I should say.
Yes. The other thing that I think, though, is that the sort of traditional milestones still act as a pressure for young people. Mm. So even if, they see no likelihood of being able to own a home themselves, it still is a strong aspiration. Mm. So there's something about we also need to sort of catch up in our own minds or young people's own minds about what is a sense of achievement and adulthood that's kind of appropriate to the circumstances in which we live right now. I was thinking about the issue around co-residence, this leaving home later, or kind of bouncing back between home, whether it's home and university or work, and then things go wrong. This is a really profound change. Well, it's a profound change for, in relation to just previous generations and in the context of the UK. There are also big differences. So big differences both by social class, by ethnic minorities, different kind of views about what it means to live intergenerationally. We don't know much about what happens actually inside a home when you've got young ones coming backwards and forwards, but also I think big implications for inequalities, because some people have got a home that they can come back to that can support them economically, but also emotionally, a place of safety. Other people have got none. So if you look at care experienced young people who are, in foster care or residential care, they are usually catapulted prematurely into adulthood and having to manage on their own. So there are big differences within this generation and, big questions of inequality. And I don't think we yet know what it means that if you're going to have co-residence with parents and other generations or other relatives, what does that mean longer term? What kind of impact does it have on, forming a relationship? It may enable you to make different economic choices. It may hold you back.
Gosh, there's so much here. Co-residence, I sometimes say jokingly, only half jokingly, one of the biggest sources of mental distress, 18 to 34-year-olds, is actually co-residents living with their parents. And one of the biggest sources of mental stress for people in their 50s and 60s is having their 18 to 34-year-olds living with them. I mean, it's not a happy situation. I mean, you know, one component of adulthood is actually, your own space.
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah, definitely. When you look at the survey data on this, there's a real mix of unhappy and happy people in that situation. There are definitely stresses involved. There's some positives in there too, in the sense of the relationship between parents and children now is just much, much closer than it was in the past. And you look at all the time use diaries at work, and we're spending an enormous amount more time, including fathers, with their children than we did in the past. So there's a lot stronger bonds of love and connection in there. But yes, absolutely, people would still want that sense of independence. And
that's a really good point. I mean, although I make that joke, one of the pluses of co-residence and what leads up to it and what follows from it is a much better understanding and a much better relationship between parents and kids than I recall.
Absolutely. It's very clear in the data that this is based on time together. But even in the attitudes, the sense of closeness in the surveys between parents and children is much higher than it was in the past. So we've got a different view of parenting now. And it goes to one of the general points in this, that some generational discussions end up being a bit about a zero-sum game of we need to give more to the young people because the old have kind of hoarded quite a lot of stuff. The reality of this is it's about how we all see the future. The generational debate can end up being quite divisive between one cohort, one generational grouping and another. But the reality is we're so interconnected up and down the generations that one of the biggest predictors that we see of people kind of checking out of the political process or attraction to reform as a party identity is that sense of complete loss of generation-on-generation progress. And not just from young people themselves, but from the parents and grandparents of those people. So this is not a narrow debate about what do we do for Gen Z versus boomers in terms of this. This is about how do we see progress for society overall. And that is a key element of, is the system working? The perception that the system is not working for people, and that opens the door for more populist arguments about having to tear up the whole thing. So that's why this is such an important debate, is if you cannot see how your kids are going to not just have a better future than you, but even you can't see that they're not going to slip back and have a worse future or a worse experience than you did, that undermines the whole case for what are we doing as a society, because the bonds are so strong up and down the generation. So yeah, that's one of the key messages we always try to get across in the generational debate, is don't think of it as a narrow zero-sum game. This is about what does the future look like.
This season of the We Society is brought to you in association with the Nuffield Foundation. For more than 80 years, the Nuffield Foundation has funded research and innovations that sit at the heart of some of society's biggest challenges. Evidence has the power to change lives, whether it's improving educational outcomes, reducing inequality, or understanding how society is changing. The Nuffield Foundation's work helps policymakers and practitioners tackle complex problems. To find out more about the Foundation and its research centres, visit nuffieldfoundation.org. Kerry, I mean, there you are, leading this project on transitioning into adulthood. Mm-hmm. One component of that, as you've identified, is kind of mental health. But again, you could apply the same logic that Bobby's applied. You know, mental health is not just 19 to 29-year-olds. It's kind of, ubiquitous. That opens a whole other can of worms.
Mm.
Thoughts?
Yes, so that's right. We do see rises in mental health difficulties. We see that sort of across the population at large, but particularly so for children and young people. I mean, that's obviously also a reflection of the fact that these issues, the symptoms become apparent at this point in their lives. That is a big worry. In a sense, regardless of how we describe them, we have got a big issue about people feeling that they can't manage, or young people feeling they can't manage, whether it's anxiety, depression, or things that are much more serious. So we also see that self-harm has risen, and we also see that suicidal thoughts and attempts have also grown. We also see very big differences between young boys or young men and young women.
Yeah,
which is important. It's important in terms of trying to understand why they're different, whether that's because young women feel that they can express it more easily, maybe that young men's mental health or difficulties might be expressed more in terms of like behaviour or alcohol, but we don't label it in the same way. Their digital lives, their online lives may also be playing into that young women are more likely to use certain kinds of social media at an earlier stage, and boys still seem to be running around, playing with each other, having more sort of active lives. Now, that may just be a developmental sort of delay.
So isn't the story that women in their teens, kind of more social media oriented, as you just described, are more likely to get difficulties with self-image and all the rest?
Yeah.
And then, when and men are doing what you just described. And then when they get, it flips in their 20s, when suddenly the suicide rate for men starts to climb above women and they get into trouble. I mean, what's...
Yes, I mean, the suicide rate has always been greater for men than for women, but suicidal attempts and...
It's not a proxy.
And feelings. It is. But you're right, there are different things going on between men and women and those who, so, you know, non-binary or trans. I mean, there's a whole set of issues about self-perception. And probably, this sounds like a generalisation, but young women are probably more at ease with talking about and being more open about emotional issues. However you describe it, you've got mental health and low well-being issues and a health service that is really not equipped to deal with the problem that we have. And that is something that's going across, you know, from actually probably from, you know, 11 right up into people's early 20s. So we need to do, I think, a radical rethink about how we support young people when they're in school with a lot of the sort of emotional and social skills and issues around resilience, and how we can try and tackle some of these issues earlier. Because basically we've got a system that's dealing with the crisis. When we talk to young people themselves, they talked a lot about, you know, they wanted a system which would be more patient, more stable, have some continuity of care, not try to get people in through the door and out through the door in a, you know, 10-minute GP appointment. So there's a big issue because we know it has long-term consequences. It affects whether people can hold down a job, going in and out of the labour market, it affects their physical health. So the consequences are really serious. So I would say it is a solvable challenge, but we're pretty far away from it.
Mm. Let's discuss what might work. Let's kick off with social media. Mm. I mean, banning social media for school kids up to age of 16, taking soft porn off social media for kids. I mean, these are steps in the right direction, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they are. I do think they are. I mean, I was asked to go and debate Jonathan Haidt, International Psychiatrist Conference in Vancouver, about the relative impacts of social media on mental health specifically, not on the wider society. And luckily he couldn't make it, because I was quite pleased that I didn't have to debate him. Jonathan wrote a book called Anxious Generation, which has had a lot of impact around the world. When we went to Australia to do our work on mental health, Jonathan had just been through, and lots of the ministers and MPs were taking on board his points, which were basically, it's a very strong argument, which has got two elements that people don't pick up on. They pick up on the social media one a lot, that we have underprotected our children online. But it's combined with a second one, which is that we've overprotected them in real life. So we've become very health and safety in the real world, so they're not used to taking risks and managing their own resilience effectively. At the same time, we've let them loose on a social media environment where they're seeing all sorts of things that they shouldn't see. I think there's a lot of strength in that. The worry that I have is, as humans, we are very keen to find one single cause to blame for things. And, you know, it's very human characteristic, not just because it makes things simple cognitively for us, but there is an element of, that's the answer. But it also gives us a focus for action. So we can say, if we sort social media, that will take away this problem. And that's where I kind of more with the psychiatrists who are saying, yes, it's important, but it's not sufficient for sorting out these other things, which includes the economic precarity, the sense of less of a clear-cut future. COVID does have an impact on that generation quite a bit. That was a massive disruption to people who were going through transitions. And interestingly, when you ask people, we ask the public, what are the causes of this increase in common mental health disorders or other measures? They will go to the economics first, but mixed in with social media and technology, and then mixed in with COVID and the disruptions and sense of precarity from climate and climate change and war and conflict around the world. So the public have actually got quite a rounded view. They don't think there's one single cause. And when you look at Gen Z's view within that, Gen Z are much more
likely. That's a generation born since 1995.
Yeah, 96. Yeah, 96, it depends. People have different, but around that time, exactly. They have even more focus on the economics. From their perspective, it is about the milestones or inch stones that they can't get through. So I think it is part of it. And I do think, yeah, just having two teenage daughters, you can see how it disrupts. And again, Jonathan Haidt and lots of others in this space, very clear about the holistic effects, the systemic changes this brings. It's not just about your direct impact. It is then that you mean you're less physically active. It does disrupt sleep. It does disrupt social connections in the real world. It has all sorts of knock-on effects. So yes, a part of it. But I do wonder and worry, because of our natural bias to want one single cause, that we think, do that and it'll sort this. Yeah. And that is not the case. And all the hard work that Kerry's talking about retooling services and getting the support out there, is going to be really important too.
I mean, wearing a kind of hat as an economist, so much to say about, you know, why more precariousness now. China has become the workshop of the world. And of course, you know, I mean, it may be, it's communist, it's one party, it's autocracy, it's total control. But the impact of that on the well-being of people is quite striking. It's just that they know there's work, and they know they're a giant, and they know it's going to get better. And actually, a lot of what happened between 1945 and 1980 was actually, we constructed a world order that led to growth. So some of the answers to this, when you talk about retooling our services, you know, at the same time, you have to recognize that, you know, you've got an incredible public debt overhang. The solutions can't just be about retooling the National Health Service. So suddenly we find ourselves, this trio sitting in the studio. The world is on our shoulders, folks. I mean, when you hear me speak, what are you thinking, Kerry?
I'm thinking that we need to think about where we kind of move resources in order to enable this next generation to kind of thrive in the economy that we have and the changes that will be happening. So this piece of work called Skills, the Skills Imperative 2035 that Nuffield Foundation funded, you know, looks at the kind of impending changes in the labour market, but also identifies, you know, the importance of the essential employment skills, which are kind of this kind of cluster of skills, kind of wrongly labeled soft skills before. But they are things around team working and collaboration. They are about creative skills in terms of thinking about innovative solutions. They are information literacy, I mean, digital capacity and capability. They are about organisation and planning and taking decisions. This set of skills, essential employment skills, we are not doing very well at. And they identify this as being also quite closely related to social and emotional skills, which, again, we don't do very well at compared to our European neighbours. So I think there are things that we should be doing, which, you know, we could spend money that's currently not being so well spent. I mean, at the moment, we're spending a lot of money on inactivity for young people. You know, we've got a review that Alan Milburn's leading to look at that inactivity and what do we do about it. We should be thinking about how do we foster these skills within schools? How do we enable more, you know, and government has announced this, more apprenticeships, more work for experience of actually being in the workplace?
Well, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking Professor Richard Wiseman would argue that all of that, but he'd say, let's have some fun in this.
Yes.
You know, and actually make people magicians, think, study magic as a source of creativity. I mean, lots of lateral ideas like that. So in this kind of stentorian agenda, there's a bit of fun.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I'm it's going to make me think about magic skills completely differently now. We have obviously have to encourage it from nursery school onwards. I wanted to pick up at the point about digital banning social media, and just I was really struck. We had an event not that long ago where Professor Sonia Livingston talked. You know, has done lots and lots of experience in this territory and talked about the digital is both mediates all these other big structural issues as well as being a thing in itself. And we know that social media can cause harms. The evidence based on the impact of social media and poor mental health outcomes in terms of RCT type evidence is very limited. And that's partly because, you know, it's continually changing. I think the questions around a ban, I sort of feel like actually this could send an important sort of signal out in terms of trying to set a norm and also to avoid some of the, you know, the otherwise parents and their children are continually having their own sort of private battles within their home about what you can and can't do. On the other hand, there may be some real downsides about bans. At the moment, we're talking about social media, but there are all kinds of things that might push people onto ChatGPT in order to answer things that it's not supposed to answer. So, you know, I think we need to also be quite wary. And you know, there's a consultation going on. We really need a consultation. I think it's not something you just leap to. And it's not, exactly as you said earlier, Bobby, that it's not an answer to all the major challenges that young people are currently facing.
Now, we're getting towards the end of this, and we're going to start thinking about feasible solutions, evidence-based. Doing this produces these demonstrable results. Bobby?
Well, I mean, just to reflect back on your point from before, when we were talking about the mental health issue with a UK minister and laying out some of this, and just after the Jonathan Haidt kind of thesis had been put out, is he did say to us, the trouble with what you tell us is that it's all very complicated, or we need to change everything, which goes to your point about, I think you're absolutely right, that the big economic, global economic shifts and what does the future look like for growth is just so fundamental to this, as well as the shifting geopolitics. So, you cannot ignore that. But on your question, I mean, a lot of my work is about misunderstandings and lack of communication between generations, which is all completely built on our natural human bias to think this is the worst generation of young people ever. And that's kind of like a constant throughout history, all the way back to Socrates and et cetera, that we've got this sense that these are the worst generation of young people we've ever had. And you've got long diatribes in every era about how these are uniquely wrong or weird young people that we've got with us now. So you've got that combined with a social media and information environment that stereotypes and creates conflict between groups as a way of working, not as built into the system, combined with a third element, which is increased generational separation, which we have just not noticed. And this is so important. So there's lots of US academics who talk about how we're living through a dangerous experiment in age segregation in society, where we have sorted younger people into cities and older people outside cities. And to quite extraordinary degrees, when you look at the census over the past 50 years, it just wasn't the case up until 1991 that you had this age profile in cities compared to outside cities. This is a new way of living that we think is natural. We ask people in polling, do you think young people tend to live in cities, old people outside? And they say yes. You ask them, has that always been the case for the last 50 or 60 years? They say yes, when it's really very new as a way of living. On top of a digital life becoming more important to us. And again, we got a sense that older people are online more, but they're not near. The biggest gaps I've seen between generations are still on technology use and the types of platforms they're on, et cetera. So separation is at the core of a lot of this misunderstanding and disconnection. If I was doing one thing around trying to get to better solutions around what does the future look like for young people, it would be really focus on intergenerational connection and in different ways. We've lost so much of the structures in where we live, in our digital lives, in the community groups that Kerry was talking about. The thing that I do most now is workshops and away days, strategy sessions for corporates and others. When they ask me to come in to help them design a Gen Z workplace strategy, and I try to get them to the conclusion themselves that that's exactly the wrong question, that you need to generate a intergenerational workplace strategy to make connections, because so much of the things that you assume about Gen Z are not true. They are not lazy, entitled, only care about work-life balance, horrible employees that you think they are. We need to make that connection first so that you understand each other both ways. So if I was trying to make any kind of prescription for how do we get to a better future on this, it is intergenerational connection is something that we've lost and not realized that we've lost outside the family. So this is not in the family. We've got to become, our intergenerational connections have become very beanpole, just us and parents, grandparents and that, nothing out into the wider society. And if we could connect more, we would come up with much better solutions to this that's not based on misunderstanding.
When you're listening to that, I mean, you'll be thinking, you know, you've got this study, transitions on 90 to 29-year-olds, but actually there's a kind of another leg of it, surely. And aren't you thinking that as you hear it, Bobby?
Yes. Having an intergenerational approach to tackling these issues, I find very appealing. But of course, we are currently in a situation where there's some major challenges that this generation of young people are facing. So I would say, if I look at the government's initiative, so, you know, they've published a national youth strategy. They've worked very closely with young people themselves to co-design it. This is the National Youth Strategy. It's Youth Matters, but it combines the range of sort of economic policies that are, you know, are in hand in terms of rises in the minimum wage, youth guarantee, investment in youth services. I mean, new initiatives that are trying to integrate services more. They're quite small scale right now. They have echoes of Sure Start, but are much more preliminary, I would say. So they're employment youth hubs. There's an attempt to have what they call young futures hubs, which are really focused on the young people that are really facing a lot of difficulties. So it's not just employment, but it's a whole host of other issues that they need support with. So I think there's some good things that the government has in place that are, you know, some stakes in the ground that can make a difference to young people's lives. But obviously, we're in very difficult kind of financial circumstances. It's not transformational. And I think if we are to be more ambitious, then we need to think more boldly about not just the way in which the government can support young people, but also employers, also civil society. It's back to the title of the podcast. The We Society is really about having a collaborative and sort of, it's like a sort of active social contract that operates between generations to support those who most need.
The We Society, an active social contract. I really like it. Let's wind up. I'm going to give you both an opportunity to have kind of last word. Come on.
Yeah, well, look, that inspired me to think the other key message from all of my work across generations is that a lot of generational action takes time, because by definition is intergenerational. Mm. And the biggest problem that we end up with is our short-termism built into our system, parliamentary system. So if I could do one additional thing, it would be, can we embed a proper futures-looking element of our policymaking? And there's lots of people looking at, can we create a national strategy for the UK that goes beyond parliamentary terms, where people are agreed that these few issues are clearly generational, in the sense that you're not going to sort out housing in one parliament. You're going to have to do this across 20 or 30 years. Can we agree to have some sort of consensus that allows us to take some things across those types of cycles? And I think without that sense of long-termism, increasing that sense of long-termism, you are by definition hampering your ability to deal with truly generational challenges. So interconnection and longer term view would be the things that would really help.
And Kerry, just a sentence or two.
Draw on young people's experience and knowledge if we're trying to solve issues for that generation. It's empowering them and working with them to develop solutions rather than us thinking, you know, about them.
Well, thank you both. I mean, really, what a tour of the horizon. Social media, the property market, co-residence, and an active social contract. I mean, my big takeaway from this kind of particular podcast is just that actually one's kind of always kind of designing a social contract. It's going to have this kind of flow of resources. It's going to have this institutional population with it. But you're not thinking of it as kind of active, ongoing. And I that's really kind of a... I'm not quite sure what that means in practice, but I know it's the right direction of travel. Thank you both very much. Thank you. Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences in association with the Leverhulme Trust and the Nuffield Foundation. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. And thank you so much for listening.